Well, before long, the shrews and the ants and the birds started to run into each other and have skirmishes of their own, and so at that point they called a truce. The king of the birds, the king of the shrews, and the queen of the ants all got together on top of the rock to parley. In the meantime, they left us dinosaurs alone, seeing that we were trapped in any case. The situation struck me as unfair, so I approached the rock where these despicable micro-monarchs were chattering away a mile a minute, and spoke. "Yo, aren't you going to invite the king of the reptiles?" They looked at me like I was crazy.
"Reptiles are obsolete," said the king of the shrews.
"Reptiles are just retarded birds," said the king of the birds, "and so I'm your king, thank you very much."
"There's only zero of you," said the queen of the ants.
In ant arithmetic, there are only two numbers, zero, which means anything less than a million, and some.
"You can't cooperate, so even if you were king, the title would be meaningless."
"Besides," said the king of the shrews, "the purpose of this summit conference is to decide which of our kingdoms shall eat which dinosaur, and we do not suppose that the king of the dinosaurs, even if there were such a thing, would be able to participate constructively."
Mammals always talk this way to show off their oversized brains, which were basically the same as ours, but burdened with a lot of useless extra business on top. Useless, I should say, but darn tasty.
"But there are three kingdoms and four dinosaurs," I pointed out. Of course, this was not true in ant arithmetic, so the queen of the ants immediately began to make a fuss. In the end, I had to go over among the ants and crush them with my tail until I had killed a few million, which is the only way that you can get an ant to take you seriously.
"Surely three dinosaurs would be enough to give all of your subjects a square meal," I said.
"May I suggest that the birds peck Pteranodon to the bone, the shrews tear Utahraptor limb from limb, and the ants feast on the corpse of Ankylosaurus?"
The three monarchs appeared to be considering this suggestion when Utahraptor sped up in a huff.
"Excuse me, your royal highnesses, but who appointed this fellow king? I'm just as qualified to be king as he."
In short order, Pteranodon and Ankylosaurus also laid claim to the throne. The king of the shrews, the king of the birds, and the queen of the ants told us all to shut up, and then conferred amongst themselves for a few minutes. Finally, the king of the shrews stepped forward.
"We have reached a decision," he said. "Three dinosaurs will be eaten, and one, the king of the reptiles, will be spared. All that remains is for one of you to demonstrate that you are superior to the other three and deserve to wear the crown."
"Very well," I said, and turned on Utahraptor, who began backing away from me, hissing and swiping the air with his giant claws. If I could dispatch Utahraptor with a frontal assault, Pteranodon would swoop down to steal some of the carrion, and I could ambush her then. Having fortified myself by eating the other two, I might be strong enough to overcome Ankylosaurus.
"No, no, no," screamed the king of the shrews. "This is just the kind of thing I was talking about when I said you reptiles were obsolete. It's not about who is the biggest and baddest anymore."
"It's about cooperation, organization, regimentation," said the queen of the ants.
"It's about brains," said the king of the shrews.
"It's about beauty, glory, dazzling flights of inspiration," said the king of the birds.
This precipitated another stridulant dispute among the two kings and the queen. Everyone got very short-tempered, and there probably would have been serious trouble if the tide had not come in and washed a few whale carcasses and dead elasmosaurs onto the beach. As you can imagine, we fell upon these gifts with abandon, and while I was eating my fill, I also managed to swallow innumerable birds, shrews, and ants who were feasting on the same pieces of meat as I. After everyone had filled their bellies and calmed down somewhat, the kings and the queen resumed their discussions. Finally, the king of the shrews, who seemed to be the designated spokesmonarch, stepped forward again.
"We cannot come to an agreement as to which of you should be the king of the reptiles. So each of our nations, birds, mammals, and ants, will put each of you to a trial, and then we will gather again and put it to a vote. If the vote results in a tie, we will eat all four of you and bring the kingdom of reptiles to an end."
We drew lots, and I was chosen to go among the ants for the first round of trials. I followed the queen into the midst of her army, picking my way slowly until the queen said,
"Step lively, lung breather. Time is food. Don't worry about those ants beneath your feet. You can't possibly kill more than zero."
so from then on I just walked normally, though my claws became slick with crushed ants. We travelled south for a day or two, and then stopped on a stream bank.
South of here is the territory of the King of the Cockroaches. Your first task is to bring me the head of the king.
Looking across the river, I could see that the entire countryside was swarming with an infinite number of cockroaches, more than I could ever stomp. And even if I could stomp them all, there must be more below the ground, which was doubtless where the king lived. I waded across the river and travelled through the kingdom of the cockroaches for 3 days until I crossed another river and entered into the kingdom of the bees. This place was greener than any I'd seen for a while, with many wild flowers, and bees swarmed everywhere taking nectar back to their nests, which were as big as houses. This gave me an idea. I toppled several hollow trees filled with honey, dragged them back to the kingdom of the cockroaches, split them open, and made sticky honey trails leading down toward the ocean. The cockroaches followed the trails down to the water's edge, where the waves broke over their heads and drowned them. For 3 days, I kept watch over the beach as the number of cockroaches dwindled, and finally, on the third day, the King of the Roaches emerged from his throne room to see where everyone had gone. I coaxed him onto a leaf and carried him back north across the river and into the kingdom of the ants, much to the amazement of the queen. Next, I was put into the care of the King of the Birds. He and his chirping, chattering army led me up into the mountains, up above the snow line, and I was sure that I would freeze to death. But as we continued up, it suddenly became warmer, which I did not understand until I realized that we were approaching a live volcano. We finally stopped at the edge of a red-hot lava flow half a mile wide. In the center of the flow, a tall black rock stood out like an island in the middle of a river. The King of the Birds plucked one golden feather from his tail and gave it to a soldier, who took it in his beak, flew over the lava, and left that feather on the very top of the black rock. By the time that soldier flew back, he was half-roasted from the heat radiating from the lava, and don't think my mouth didn't water.
"Your job," said the king, "is to bring me that feather."
Now, this was clearly unfair, and I protested that the birds were obviously trying to favour Pteranodon. This kind of argument might have worked with ants or even shrews, but the King of the Birds would hear none of it. For them, virtue consisted in being bird-like, and fairness didn't enter into it. Well, I stood on the edge of that lava flow until my skin smoked, but I couldn't see how to reach that feather. Finally, I decided to give up. I was walking away, cutting my feet on the sharp rock, when suddenly it hit me. The rock I'd been standing on this whole time was nothing other than lava that had gotten cold and solidified. This was high in the mountains, where glaciers and snowfields soared above me like palace walls. I climbed up onto a particularly steep slope and began pounding the snow with my tail until I started an avalanche. Millions of tons of ice and snow thundered down onto the lava flow, throwing up a tremendous blast of steam. For 3 days and nights, I could not see the claws in front of my face for all of the steam. But on the third day, it finally cleared away, and I saw a bridge of hardened lava running straight to that black rock. I scampered across, to the extent that a dinosaur can scamper, snatched that golden feather, ran back, and stood in the snow for a while, cooling my feet off. Then I marched back to the King of the Birds, who was, of course, astonished. Next, I found myself in the care of the mammals, who were almost all shrews. They led me up into the foothills to the mouth of a great cave.
"Your job," said the King of the Shrews, "is to wait here for Dojo, and then defeat him in single combat."
Then all the shrews went away and left me there alone. I waited in front of that cave for 3 days and 3 nights, which gave me plenty of time to scope the place out. At first, I was rather cocky about this challenge, for it seemed the easiest of the three. While I had no idea who or what Dojo was, I knew that in all the world I had never met my equal when it came to single combat. But on the first day, sitting there on my tail waiting for Dojo, I noticed a sprinkling of small glittering objects on the ground, and examining them carefully, I realized that they were, in fact, scales. To be precise, they were dinosaur scales, which I recognized as belonging to Pteranodon, Ankylosaurus, and Uteraptor, and they appeared to have been jarred loose from their bodies by powerful impacts.
On the second day, I prowled around the vicinity and found tremendous gashes in tree trunks, which had undoubtedly been made by Utahraptor as he slashed wildly at Dojo. Other trees had been snapped off entirely by the club at the end of the tail of Ankylosaurus, and long scratches in the earth made by the talons of Pteranodon as she dove again and again at some elusive opponent. At this point, I became concerned. It was clear that all three of my opponents had fought Dojo and lost. So if I lost also, which was inconceivable, I would be even with the others. But the rules of the contest stated that in the event of a tie, all four dinosaurs would be eaten and the kingdom of the reptiles would be no more. I spent the night fretting about who or what the terrible Dojo was. On the third day, nothing happened, and I began wondering whether I should go into the cave and look for Dojo. So far, the only living thing I'd seen around here was a black mouse that occasionally darted out from the rocks at the cave's entrance, foraging for a bit of food. The next time I saw that mouse, I said, speaking softly so as not to scare it, "Say, mouse, is there anything back inside that cave?" The black mouse sat up on its haunches, holding a huckleberry between its little hands and nibbling on it. "Nothing special," he said. "Just my little dwelling. A fireplace, some tiny pots and pans, a few dried berries, and the rest is full of skeletons." "Skeletons," I said, "of other mice?" "There are a few mouse skeletons, but mostly they're dinosaurs of one kind or another, primarily meat-eaters." "Who've become extinct because of the comet," I suggested. "Oh, pardon me, sir, but I must respectfully inform you that the deaths of these dinosaurs are unrelated to the comet."
"How did they die, then?" I asked.
"I regret to say that I killed them all in self-defense."
"Ah," I said, not quite believing it. "Then you must be..."
"Dojo the Mouse," he said, "at your service."
"I am terribly sorry to have bothered you, sir," I said, using my best manners, for I could see that this Dojo was an unusually polite sort. "But your fame as a warrior has spread far and wide, and I have come here humbly to seek your advice on how I may become a better warrior myself. For it has not escaped my notice that in the post-comet environment, teeth like carving knives and 6 tons of muscle may be in some sense outmoded." What follows is a rather long story, for Dojo had much to teach me, and he taught it slowly. Sometime, Nell, I will teach you everything I learned from Dojo. All you need do is ask. But on the third day of my apprenticeship, when I still had not learned anything except humility, good manners, and how to sweep out the cave, I asked Dojo if he would be interested in playing a game of tic-tac-toe. This was a common sport among dinosaurs. We would scratch it out in the mud. Many paleontologists have been baffled to find tic-tac-toe games littering prehistoric excavations and have chalked it up to the local workers they hire to do their digging and hauling. In any case, I explained the rules of the game to Dojo, and he agreed to give it a try. We went down to the nearest mud flat, and there, in plain view of many shrews, I played a game of tic-tac-toe with Dojo and vanquished him, although I will confess it was touch-and-go for a while. It was done. I had defeated Dojo in single combat. The next morning, I excused myself from Dojo's cave and went back down to the beach where the other three dinosaurs had already gathered, looking much the worse for wear, as you can imagine. The King of the Shrews, the King of the Birds, and the Queen of the Ants converged on us with all their armies and crowned me King of the Reptiles, or Tyrannosaurus Rex, as we used to say. Then they ate the other three dinosaurs as agreed. Besides me, the only reptiles left were a few snakes, lizards, and turtles, who continued to be my obedient subjects. I could have lived a luxurious life as a king, but by now Dojo had taught me humility, and so I went back to his cave immediately and spent the next few million years studying his ways. All you need do is ask, Nell, and I will pass his knowledge on to you.
Judge Fang goes for a dinner cruise with the Mandarin. They visit a mysterious ship, a startling discovery. A trap is sprung.
Dr. X's boat was not the traditional sort of wallowing pleasure barge that was fit only for the canals and shallow lakes of the Yangtze's sodden delta. It was a real ocean-going yacht built on Western lines.
Judging from the delicacies that began to make their way up to the foredeck shortly after Judge Fang came aboard, the vessel's galley had been retrofitted with all the accoutrements of a professional Chinese kitchen. Umbrella-sized woks, gas burners like howling turbojets, and extensive storage lockers for innumerable species of fungi, as well as bird nests, shark fins, chicken feet, fetal rats, and odds and ends of many other species both rare and ubiquitous. The courses of the meal were small, numerous, and carefully timed, served up in an array of fine porcelain that could have filled several rooms of the Victoria and Albert Museum, delivered with the precision of surgical airstrikes by a team of waiters. Judge Fang got to eat this way only when someone really important was trying to taint him, and though he had never knowingly allowed his judicial judgment to be swayed, he did enjoy the chow. They began with tea and some preliminary courses on the foredeck of the yacht, as it made its way down the Huang Pu, with the old European buildings of the Bund on the left, lit up eerily by the wash of colored light radiating from the developments of Pudong, which rose precipitously from the bank on the right. At one point, Dr. X had to excuse himself below decks for a few moments. Judge Fang strolled to the very bow of the yacht, nestled himself into the acute angle formed by the converging rails, let the wind tug at his beard, and enjoyed the view. The tallest buildings in Pudong were held up by huge aerostats, vacuum-filled ellipsoids hundreds of stories above street level, much wider than the buildings they supported, and usually covered with lights. Some of these extended out over the river itself. Judge Fang rested his elbows carefully on the rail to maintain his balance, then tilted his head back so that he was staring straight up at the underside of one such, pulsing with oversaturated colored light. The trompe l'oeil was enough to make him dizzy, and so he quickly looked down. Something thumped against the hull of the yacht, and he looked into the water to see a human corpse wrapped up in a white sheet, blundering along a foot or two beneath the surface, dimly luminescent in the light from the building overhead. In time, the yacht made its way out into the estuary of the Yangtze, only a few miles from the East China Sea at this point, miles wide, and much colder and rougher. Judge Fang and Dr. X repaired to a dining cabin below decks, with panoramic windows that mostly just reflected back the light of the candles and lanterns around the table. Not long after they had taken their seats, the yacht accelerated powerfully, first shooting forward and then leaping up out of the water before resuming its steady, level motion. Judge Fang realized that the yacht was actually a hydrofoil, which had been merely idling along on her hull while they had enjoyed the city view, but which now climbed up out of the water. The conversation so far had consisted almost entirely of formal courtesies. This had eventually led them into a discussion of Confucian philosophy and traditional culture, clearly a subject of interest to both of them. Judge Fang had complimented the doctor on his sublime calligraphy, and they talked about that art for a while. Then, obligatorily returning the compliment, Dr. X told the judge how superbly he was executing his duties as magistrate, particularly given the added difficulty of having to deal with barbarians.
"Your handling of the affair of the girl and the book was, in particular, a credit to your abilities," Dr. X said gravely.
Judge Fang found it interesting that the boy who had actually stolen the book was not mentioned. He supposed that Dr. X was referring not so much to the criminal case as to Judge Fang's subsequent efforts to protect the girl.
"This person is grateful, but all credit should go to the master," Judge Fang said. "The prosecution of this case was founded entirely upon his principles, as you might have seen had you been able to do us the honor of joining our discussion of the matter at the house of the venerable and inscrutable colonel."
"Ah, it is indeed a misfortune that I could not attend," the doctor said, "as it would, no doubt, have helped to improve my own so imperfect understanding of the master's principles."
"I meant no such insinuation. Rather, that the doctor might have guided me and my staff to a more nearly adequate resolution of the affair than we were, in fact, able to devise."
"Perhaps it would have been good fortune for both of us for me to have been present in the colonel's house on that day,"
Dr. X said, returning neatly to equilibrium. There was silence for a few minutes as a new course was brought out, plum wine poured by the waiter. Then Dr. X continued,
"One aspect of the case on which I would have been particularly eager to consult your wisdom would have been the disposition of the book."
So he was still stuck on that book. Though it had been weeks since Dr. X had released any more of those book-hunting mites into the airspace of the leased territories, Judge Fang knew that he was still offering a nice bounty to anyone who could tell him the whereabouts of the book in question. Judge Fang was beginning to wonder whether this obsession with the book might be a symptom of a general decline in the doctor's mental powers.
"Your advice on the subject would have been of inestimable value to me," Judge Fang said, "as this aspect of the case was particularly troublesome for a Confucian judge. If the item of stolen property had been anything other than a book, it would have been confiscated. But a book is different. It is not just a material possession, but the pathway to an enlightened mind, and thence to a well-ordered society, as the master stated many times."
"I see,"
said Dr. X, slightly taken aback. He seemed genuinely thoughtful as he stroked his beard and stared into the flame of a candle, which had suddenly begun to flicker and gyrate chaotically. It seemed as though the judge had raised a novel point here which deserved careful consideration.
"Better to leave the book in the hands of one who could benefit from its wisdom than to let it remain inert in a police warehouse."
"That was my, no doubt, less than perfect conclusion hastily arrived at," Judge Fang said.
Dr. X continued to ponder the matter for a minute or so.
"It does credit to your professional integrity that you are able to focus so clearly upon the case of one small person.
As you will no doubt appreciate, being a far more accomplished scholar than I, the interests of the society come first. Beside that, the fate of one little girl is nothing. But other things being equal, it is better for society that the girl is educated than that she remain ignorant."
Dr. X raised his eyebrows and nodded significantly at this. The subject did not come up again during the rest of the meal. He assumed that the hydrofoil was swinging around in a lazy circle that would eventually take them back to the mouth of the Huang Pu. But when the engines were throttled back and the craft settled back onto its hull and began to rock with the waves again, Judge Fang could not see any lights outside the windows. They were nowhere near Pudong, nor any other inhabited land as far as he could tell. Dr. X gestured out of the window at nothing and said,
"I have taken the liberty of arranging this visit for you. It touches upon a case that has recently come under your purview and also has to do with a subject that seems of particular interest to you and which we have already discussed this evening."
When Judge Fang followed his host out onto the deck, he was finally able to make out their surroundings. They were on the open ocean, with no land in sight, though the urban glow of Greater Shanghai could clearly be seen to the west. It was a clear night, with a nearly full moon that was illuminating the hull of an enormous ship nearby. Even without the moonlight, this vessel would have been noticeable, for the fact that it blocked out all of the stars in one quadrant of the sky. Judge Fang knew next to nothing about ships. He had toured an aircraft carrier in his youth when it docked for a few days in Manhattan. He suspected that this ship was even larger. It was almost entirely dark, except for pinpricks of red light here and there, suggesting its size and general shape, and a few horizontal lines of yellow light shining out of the windows of its superstructure, many stories above their heads. Dr. X and Judge Fang were conveyed on board this vessel by a small crew who came out to meet them in a launch. As it drew alongside the doctor's yacht, the judge was startled to realize that its crew consisted entirely of young women. Their accents marked them as belonging to an ethnic subgroup, common in the Southeast, that lived almost entirely on the water. But even if they had not spoken, Judge Fang would have inferred this from their nimble handling of the boat. Within a few minutes, Dr. X and Judge Fang had been conveyed aboard the giant vessel through a hatch set into the hull near the waterline. Judge Fang noted that this was not an old-fashioned steel vessel. It was made of nanotechnological substances, infinitely lighter and stronger. No matter compiler in the world was large enough to compile a ship, so the shipyards in Hong Kong had compiled the pieces one by one, bonded them together, and slid them down the ways into the sea, much as their pre-Diamond Age predecessors had done. Judge Fang had been expecting that the ship would be some kind of bulk carrier, consisting almost entirely of huge compartments. But the first thing he saw was a long corridor running parallel to the keel, seemingly the length of the entire ship. Young women in white, pink, or occasionally blue dresses and sensible shoes bustled back and forth along this corridor, entering into and emerging from its innumerable doors. There was no formal welcome, no captain or other officers. As soon as the boat girls had assisted them on board, they bowed and took their leave. Dr. X began to amble down the corridor, and Judge Fang followed him. The young women in the white dresses bowed as they approached, then continued on their way, having no time to waste on advanced formalities. Judge Fang had the general sense that they were peasant women, though none of them had the deep tans that were normally a mark of low social status in China. The boat girls had worn blue, so he gathered that this color identified people with nautical or engineering duties. In general, the ones in the pink dresses were younger and slenderer than the ones in the white dresses. The tailoring was different, too. The pink dresses closed up the middle of the back, the white ones had two zippers symmetrically placed in the front. Dr. X chose a door, apparently at random, swung it open, and held it for Judge Fang. Judge Fang bowed slightly and stepped through it into a room about the dimensions of a basketball court, though with a lower ceiling. It was quite warm and humid and dimly lit. The first thing he saw was more girls in white dresses bowing to him. Then he realized that the room was otherwise filled with cribs, hundreds of cribs, and that each crib had a perfect little girl baby in it. Young women in pink bustled back and forth with diapers. From place to place, a woman sat beside a crib, the front of her white dress unzipped, breastfeeding a baby. Judge Fang felt dizzy. He was not willing to acknowledge the reality of what he saw. He had mentally prepared himself for tonight's meeting with Dr. X by reminding himself over and over that the doctor was capable of any trickery, that he could not take anything he saw at face value. But as many first-time fathers had realized in the delivery room, there was something about the sight of an actual baby that focused the mind. In a world of abstractions, nothing was more concrete than a baby. Judge Fang whirled on his heel and stormed out of the room, brushing rudely past Dr. X. He picked a direction at random and walked, strode, ran down the corridor, past 5 doors, 10, 50, then stopped for no particular reason and burst through another door. It might as well have been the same room. He felt almost nauseous and had to take stern measures to keep tears from his eyes. He ran out of the room and stormed through the ship for some distance, going up several stairways past several decks. He stepped into another room chosen at random and found the floor covered with cribs, evenly spaced in rows and columns, each one containing a sleeping one-year-old, dressed in fuzzy pink jammies with a hood and a set of mouse ears, each one clutching an identical white security blanket and nestled up with a stuffed animal. Here and there, a young woman in a pink dress sat on the floor on a bamboo mat, reading a book or doing needlework. One of these women, close to Judge Fang, set her needlework down, rearranged herself into a kneeling position, and bowed to him. Judge Fang gave her a perfunctory bow in return, then padded over to the nearest crib. A little girl with astonishingly thick eyelashes lay there, deeply asleep, breathing regularly, her mouse ears sticking out through the bars of the crib. And as Judge Fang stood and stared at her, he imagined that he could hear the breathing of all the children on the ship at once, combined into a gentle sigh that calmed his heart. All of these children sleeping so peacefully. Everything must be okay. It was going to be fine. He turned away and saw that the young woman was smiling at him. It was not a flirting smile or a silly girlish smile, but a calm and confident smile. Judge Fang supposed that wherever Dr. X was on this ship, he must be smiling in much the same way at this moment. When Dr. X started the cine, Judge Fang recognized it right away. This was the work of the mediographer Firefox, who was still, as far as he knew, languishing in a holding cell in downtown Shanghai. The setting was an outcropping of stones amid a dun, dust-scoured vastitude, somewhere in the interior of China. The camera panned across the surrounding waste, and Judge Fang did not have to be told that these had once been fertile fields before the water table had been drained out from under them. A couple of people approached, kicking up a plume of dust as they walked, carrying a small bundle. As they drew closer, Judge Fang could see that they were horrifyingly gaunt, dressed in dirty rags. They came to the center of the rocky outcropping and laid the bundle on the ground, then turned and walked away. Judge Fang turned away from the Mediatron and dismissed it with a wave of the hand. He did not have to see it to know that the bundle was a baby, probably female.
This scene could have happened any time in the history of China, Dr. X said. They were sitting in a rather Spartan wardroom in the vessel's superstructure.
It has always been done with us. The great rebellions of the 1800s were fueled by throngs of angry young men who could not find wives. In the darkest days of the Mao dynasty's birth control policy, 200,000 little ones were exposed in this fashion, he gestured toward the frozen image on the mediatron, each year. Recently, with the coming of civil war and the draining of the celestial kingdom's aquifers, it has once again become common. The difference is that now the babies are collected. We have been doing it for 3 years.
How many? Judge Fang said.
A quarter of a million to date, Dr. X said. 50,000 on this ship alone.
Judge Fang had to set his teacup down for a few moments while he grappled with this notion. 50,000 lives on this ship alone.
It won't work, Judge Fang said finally. You can raise them this way until they are toddlers, perhaps. But what happens when they're older and bigger, and must be educated and given space to run around and play?
It is indeed a formidable challenge, Dr. X said gravely. But I trust you will take to heart the words of the Master. Let every man consider virtue as what devolves on himself. He may not yield the performance of it even to his teacher. I wish you good fortune, Magistrate.
This statement had much the same effect as if Dr. X had hit the judge over the head with a board. Startling, yes, but the full impact was somehow delayed.
I'm not sure if I follow you, Doctor.
Dr. X crossed his wrists and held them up in the air.
I surrender. You may take me into custody. Torture will not be necessary. I have already prepared a signed confession.
Judge Fang had not hitherto realized that Dr. X had such a well-developed sense of humor. He decided to play along.
As much as I would like to bring you to justice, Doctor, I am afraid that I cannot accept your surrender as we are out of my jurisdiction.
The doctor nodded to a waiter, who swung the cabin door open to let in a cool breeze and a view of the gaudy waterfront of the leased territories, suddenly no more than a mile away from them.
As you can see, I have ordered the ships to come into your jurisdiction, Your Honor,
Dr. X said. He gestured invitingly out the door. Judge Fang stepped out onto an open gangway and looked over the rail to see four other giant ships following in this one's wake. Dr. X's reedy voice came out through the open door.
You may now take me and the crew of these ships to prison for the crime of baby smuggling. You may also take into custody these ships and all 250,000 of the little mice on board. I trust you can find qualified caregivers somewhere within your jurisdiction.
Judge Fang gripped the rail with both hands and bowed his head. He was very close to clinical shock. It would be perfectly suicidal to call the doctor's bluff. The concept of having personal responsibility for so many lives was terrifying enough in and of itself. But to think of what would eventually become of all these little girls in the hands of the corrupt officialdom of the Coastal Republic. Dr. X continued.
I have no doubt that you will find some way to care for them. As you have demonstrated in the case of the book and the girl, you are too wise a magistrate not to understand the importance of proper upbringing of small children. No doubt you will exhibit the same concern for each one of these 250,000 infants as you did for one little barbarian girl.
Judge Fang stood up straight, whirled, and strode back through the door.
Shut the door and leave the room, he said to the waiter.
When he and the doctor were alone together, Judge Fang faced Dr. X, descended to his knees, bent forward, and knocked his forehead against the deck 3 times.
Please, Your Honor, Dr. X exclaimed. It is I who should be doing honor to you in this way.
For some time, I've been contemplating a change of career, Judge Fang said, rising to an upright kneeling position. He stopped before continuing and thought it through once more, but Dr. X had left him no way out. It would have been uncharacteristic of the doctor to spring a trap that could be escaped. As the master had said, the mechanic who wishes to do his work well must first sharpen his tools. When you are living in any state, take service with the most worthy among its great officers and make friends of the most virtuous among its scholars. Actually, I am satisfied with my career, but dissatisfied with my tribal affiliation. I have grown disgusted with the Coastal Republic and have concluded that my true home lies in the Celestial Kingdom. I have often wondered whether the Celestial Kingdom is in need of magistrates, even those as poorly qualified as I.
This is a question I will have to take up with my superiors, Dr. X said. However, given that the Celestial Kingdom currently has no magistrates whatsoever, and therefore no real judicial system, I deem it likely that some role can be found for one with your superb qualifications.
I see now why you desire the little girl's book so strongly, Judge Fang said. These young ones must all be educated.
I do not desire the book itself so much as I desire its designer, the artifex Hackworth, Dr. X said. As long as the book was somewhere in the leased territories, there was some hope that Hackworth could find it. It is the one thing he desires most. If I could have found the book, I could have extinguished that hope, and Hackworth would then have had to approach me, either to get the book back or to compile another copy.
You desire some service from Hackworth?
He is worth 1,000 lesser engineers. And because of various hardships over the last few decades, the Celestial Kingdom does not have even that many lesser engineers. They have all been lured away by the promise of riches in the Coastal Republic.
I will approach Hackworth tomorrow, Judge Fang said. I will inform him that the man known to the barbarians as Dr. X has found the lost copy of the book.
Good, Dr. X said. I shall expect to hear from him.
Hackworth's Dilemma, an unanticipated return to the Hong of Dr. X. Hitherto unseen ramifications of Dr. X's premises. A criminal is brought to justice.
Hackworth had some time to run through the logic of the thing one more time as he waited in the front room of Dr. X's Hong, waiting for the old man to free himself up from what sounded like a 12-way cine conference. On his first visit here, he'd been too nervous to see anything, but today he was settled cozily in the cracked leather armchair in the corner, demanding tea from the help and thumbing through Dr. X's books. It was such a relief to have nothing to lose. Since that deeply alarming visit from Chang, Hackworth had been at his wit's end. He'd made an immense cock-up of the whole thing. Sooner or later, his crime would come out, and his family would be disgraced whether or not he gave money to Chang. Even if he somehow managed to get the primer back, his life was ruined. When he had received word that Dr. X had won the race to recover the lost copy of the primer, the thing had turned from bad to farcical. He had cut a day at work and gone for a long hike in the Royal Ecological Conservatory. By the time he had returned home, sunburned and pleasantly exhausted, he had been in a much better mood. That Dr. X had the primer actually improved his situation. In exchange for the primer, the doctor would presumably want something from Hackworth. In this case, it was not likely to be a mere bribe, as Chang had hinted. All of the money Hackworth had or was ever likely to make could not be of interest to Dr. X. It was much more likely that the doctor would want some sort of a favor. He might ask Hackworth to design something, to do a little bit of consulting work, as it were. Hackworth wanted so badly to believe this that he had bolstered the hypothesis with much evidence, real and phantasmal, during the latter part of his hike. It was well known that the Celestial Kingdom was desperately far behind in the nanotechnological arms race. That Dr. X himself devoted his valuable time to rooting through the debris of the New Atlantan immune system proved this. Hackworth's skills could be of measureless value to them. If this were true, then Hackworth had a way out. He would do some job for the doctor. In exchange, he would get the primer back, which was what he wanted more than anything. As part of the deal, Dr. X could no doubt find some way to eliminate Chang from Hackworth's list of things to worry about. Hackworth's crime would never be known to his file. Victorians and Confucians alike had learned new uses for the foyer, anteroom, or whatever it was called, and for the old etiquette of visiting cards. For that matter, all tribes with sophistication in nanotech understood that visitors had to be carefully examined before they could be admitted into one's inner sanctum, and that such examination, carried out by thousands of assiduous reconnaissance mites, took time. so elaborate waiting room etiquette had flourished, and sophisticated people all over the world understood that when they called upon someone, even a close friend, they could expect to spend some time sipping tea and perusing magazines in a front room infested with unobtrusive surveillance equipment. One entire wall of Dr. X's front room was a Mediatron. Cinefeeds, or simple stationary graphics, could be digitally posted on such a wall just as posters and handbills had been in olden times. Over time, if not removed, they tended to overlap each other and build up into an animated collage. Centered on Dr. X's media wall, partly concealed by newer clips, was a cine clip as ubiquitous in northern China as the face of Mao, Buddha's evil twin, had been in the previous century. Hackworth had never sat and watched it all the way through, but he'd glimpsed it so many times in Pudong taxicabs and on the walls in the leased territories that he knew it by heart. Westerners called it Zhang at the Shang. The setting was the front of a luxury hotel, one of the archipelago of Shangri-Las strung up the Kowloon-Guangzhou superhighway. The horseshoe drive was paved with interlocking blocks, brass door handles gleamed, thickets of tropical flowers sprouted from boat-sized planters in the lobby. Men in business suits spoke into cell phones and checked their watches. White-gloved bellhops sprinted into the drive, pulled suitcases from the trunks of red taxicabs, wiped them down with clean, moist cloths. The horseshoe drive was plugged into an 8-lane thoroughfare, not the highway, but a mere frontage road, with a spiked iron fence running down the center to keep pedestrians from crossing in mid-block. The pavement, new but already crumbling, was streaked with red dust washed down out of the devastated hills of Guangdong by the latest typhoon. Traffic suddenly became thin, and the camera panned upstream. Several lanes had been blocked by a swarm of bicycles. Occasionally, a red taxi or Mercedes-Benz would squeeze by along the iron fence and burst free, the driver holding down the horn button so furiously that he might detonate the airbag. Hackworth could not hear the sound of the horn, but as the camera zoomed in on the action, it became possible to see one driver take his hand off the horn and turn back to shake his finger at the mob of bicyclists. When he saw who was pedaling the lead bicycle, he turned away, nauseous with fear, and his hand collapsed into his lap like a dead quail. The leader was a stocky man with white hair, 60-ish, but pumping away vigorously on an unexceptional black bicycle, wearing drab workers' clothes. He moved it down the street with deceptive speed and pulled into the horseshoe drive. An embolism of bicycles formed on the street as hundreds tried to crowd in the narrow entrance. And here came another classic moment. The head bellhop skirted his stand-up desk and ran toward the bicyclist, waving him off and hurling abuse in Cantonese, until he got about 6 feet away and realized he was looking at Zhang Han Hua. At this point, Zhang had no job title, being nominally retired, an ironical conceit that the Chinese premiers of the late 20th century and early 21st had perhaps borrowed from American mafia bosses. Perhaps they recognized that job titles were beneath the dignity of the most powerful man on earth. People who had gotten this close to Zhang claimed that they never thought about his temporal power, the armies, the nuclear weapons, the secret police. All they could think about was the fact that, during the Great Cultural Revolution, at the age of 18, Zhang Hanhua had led his cell of Red Guards into hand-to-hand combat with another cell that they deemed insufficiently fervid, and that, at the conclusion of the battle, Zhang had feasted on the raw flesh of his late adversaries. No one could stand face-to-face with Zhang without imagining the blood streaming down his chin. The bellhop collapses to his knees and begins literally kowtowing. Zhang looks disgusted, hooks one of his sandaled feet under the bellhop's collarbone, and prods him back upright, then speaks a few words to him in the hillbilly accent of his native Fujian. The bellhop can hardly bow enough on his way back into the hotel. Displeasure registers on Zhang's face. All he wants is some fast service. During the next minute or so, progressively higher-ranking hotel officials cringe out the door and abase themselves in front of Zhang, who simply ignores them, looking bored now. No one really knows whether Zhang is a Confucianist or a Maoist at this point in his life, but at this moment it makes no difference. For in the Confucian view of society, as in the communist, peasants are the highest class and merchants the lowest. This hotel is not for peasants. Finally, a man in a black business suit emerges, preceded and pursued by bodyguards. He looks angrier than Zhang,
thinking that he must be the victim of some unforgivable practical joke. This is a merchant among merchants, the 14th richest man in the world, the 3rd richest in China. He owns most of the real estate within half an hour's drive of this hotel. He does not break his stride as he steps into the drive and recognizes Zhang. He walks straight up to him and asks him what he wants. Why the old man has bothered to come down from Beijing and interfere with his business on his foolish bicycle ride. Zhang simply steps forward and speaks a few words into the rich man's ear. The rich man takes a step back, as if Zhang has punched him in the chest. His mouth is open, revealing flawless white teeth. His eyes are not focused. After a few moments, he takes another 2 steps back, which gives him enough room for his next maneuver. He stoops, puts one knee down, then the other, bends forward at the waist until he is on all fours, then settles himself down, full length, on the nicely interlocked paving stones. He puts his face on the pavement. He kowtows to Zhang Han Hua.